Okay, well, this is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, and we're anticipating having a great show today. We want to wine, who has some really, really great information to share with us. We've just heard an update from WPFW, streaming in collaboration with WBAI, and the Peach Me update. And the first part of the interview with her is to talk about the impeachment question, but more importantly, or equally important, whole question of mobilizing and protecting the black vote. So, Attorney Arnwine, are you there? If not, we've got to get Attorney Arnwine on the line.
Okay, she's ready.
Okay, Attorney Arnwine?
Yes.
Yeah, my apologies. We just had it, and that's why we're running late. So we want to dive right into the interview. In fact, we've just had on a collaborative stream of a segment. You probably know Askia Mohammed from WPFW.
Oh, absolutely.
Who has been giving these impeachment updates. So we just had an impeachment update. Asked you, because we really want to talk about mobilizing and protecting the black vote. But there may well be a link to the impeachment question that we should be paying attention to. And I wanted you to comment on that, because a part of this impeachment, well, one of the central pieces has to do with the Russian interference in the 2016 elections and their intent potentially to do that in the 2020 election. And I know that with the work you've been doing around that the issue of Russian interference was certainly an issue in terms of suppressing the black vote in 2016. Would you comment on that?
Yes. Well, the Senate Intelligence Committee has done an extensive report on social media. In particular, did three ugly things. One, that they were blacks. That basically those fake accounts spewed a lot of disinformation to voters and made it so that voters could not get correct information. So they were telling people, for example, that they should not vote, that their vote wouldn't be counted. They were telling people that that it was all rigged. They were doing everything they could to discourage people, telling people it was too hard to vote, that they didn't have the right ID. It was all these evil schemes of using blackface being run by Russians. The other thing they did was that they ran what you call a racial hate campaign, where they basically told white voters enemy and told black voters that whites were their number one enemy. So they used racial division to really confuse voters. And then they were actually interfering with black commerce. And they were attempting, yes, that's the one that I really need to get more of a handle on, where they were actually making it harder for black entrepreneurs to strive. Interesting, huh? So those are the really evil. Like we were talking today, I was talking to somebody about this one account that had thousands and thousands of followers, including they were, quote, woke. And in fact, the name of the account was Woke Louise. And she pretended that she was a black woman, and she would have a lot of, you know, good stuff, let's celebrate, this black person, this hero, let's make sure that we're, loving Kwanzaa, do all kinds of stuff. But when it got down to the elections, all of a sudden she started telling people that the vote wouldn't count, that they were, that they needed to sit home, that they were wasting their time, all of this stuff after building up all this trust, right? And building up all of this pretense. And it turned out Woke Louisa, all Russian. Nobody blamed. All Russian.
Right.
And literally thousands and thousands and thousands of black people. That's what they're up to. And we know right now that they're doing the same game. And Russia, really, for all of this disinformation and Facebook, and I'm sad to say this, Facebook has no strategy. no commitment to protecting our vote. In fact, everything shows that they're just going to sell these ads again to any foreign power to do this. So, yes, there's a connection with the impeachment because Donald Trump encouraged Russia to interfere the election. And,
I wanted to make that
significant.
Yeah, I want to just share with our audience. And our audience is, has been aware of some of this because we've had some of the people who work with you on the air. And by the way, to Barbara Arnwine, she is the founder and executive director of the Transformative Change, Transformative Justice Coalition. And she has her own powerful radio show called Igniting Change, which appears, it's on WOLB, is it?
Yes, right. And it's every Tuesday from 12 to 1, the show.
And if there's anybody who can ignite change, it's Attorney Barbara Arnwine. But anyway, would you just comment quickly on some of the us that were so elaborate all across the country, different methods of trying to suppress the black vote?
Oh, my goodness. There were so many. Voter ID, of course, what we call onerous voter ID. States that used to allow people to have voter ID, 13 states now only allow you to use three forms of voter ID, and that is, you know, either a driver's license or a passport or, a license bureau. But as we know in Alabama, where they passed such a onerous voter ID law and took away the ability to use, you know, your bills, your college ID, your closed DMVs all over the Department of Motor Vehicles, all over the state, especially in the black neighborhoods and in the black, the people could not actually get to a Department of Motor Vehicles. So that was evil. These onerous voter ID schemes, let people be very clear, ID schemes, photo ID schemes. Then the other thing, early voting cuts. It's clear that let love early voting. If you offer it, 50% of all blacks will vote early if given the opportunity. They will vote early. In fact, in some states, 70% of African Americans will vote early if given the opportunity. We know that in the 2018 elections, in fact, that 45% of all Latinos voted early. So what they've been doing is cutting early voting, making their fewer and fewer days. And wait a minute, Ron, getting rid of vote to the knowing that a lot of people would organize from their churches and march to the polling booth so that people could vote or would leave their churches and go straight and vote. These states have been trying to cut out and get rid of Sunday voting. The evilest scheme, one of the most evil schemes has been getting rid of polling places for people to vote. What does that mean? That means if you have fewer polling places, you got to go a longer distance to vote, and you're going to encounter people hate. And they know that a lot of people will ride up and will say, if you've been standing here, and they say 2-3 hours, they're gone. They'll just leave.
So
we know that in the 8 states that were once covered by Section 8, they eliminated. Everybody get ready. From 2012 to 2016, they eliminated 1,200 polling places.
Wow.
With more voter population increase, did not decrease.
Right.
But they got rid of 1,200 polling places.
Right. So what that says is that makes the, I don't want to vote, I don't believe it. But what this says is that somebody is scheming or some multiple series of people are scheming to make sure or to make it very, very difficult for black people to vote. And that brings us to the next question, really, because you're putting together a massive coalition in order to deal with these questions. But first of all, what's at stake? What is peculiar about this particular election that makes it so important that I use the term that black people and their allies, Latinos and others, Asians, and a coalition of conscience, Martin Luther King might say, march on ballot boxes like never before?
Oh, listen, there's one big one. Everybody should know that last night, almost in the midnight hour, the Trump administration filed a court lawsuit in California to challenge the state's new law that says that they won't invest in private prisons. They filed a lawsuit to say that that's unconstitutional, that that's wrong, and that they're violating the law, and that there should be private prisons to profit off of people being imprisoned. A lot of black folks going to jail, and it seems like we go to jail more than anybody else when if we know that we don't commit the majority of crime in this country. Because, I mean, remember that 70%+ of everybody in this country is white. So it's very important for people to understand that blacks and whites just aren't prosecuted. And they are not sent to jail. So if you care about mass incarceration, you're sick of it, if you're sick of watching, you know, people paying all this bail money, if you're sick of hearing people dying, you know, in prison because they could not pay for their bail, losing jobs, not being able to take care of their families, if you care about all that, then you absolutely want to vote, because you want to vote for not only your congresspeople, that is your U.S. Senate, House of Representatives, members, but you also want to vote for governor for your state. You want to vote for your state legislatures because they should be changing all these laws. They're the ones who should be getting rid of mass incarceration because the majority of imprisonment is at the state level. So you want to get rid of this. If you're caring about police, if you're sick of, you know, the police, you know, harassing your community, if you're sick of hearing about people being shot to death who were innocent, then you better vote because your city council, your county council, your once again, your state legislators all have authority over the police. If you care about your health care, if you're sick of seeing people sick because they cannot go to the doctor, if you always hearing that the only way they get medical care is by going to the emergency room because they hope somebody will take them if they're sick, and that once again, the Trump administration right now, I'm just being honest about what's happening. I'm not being partisan, but the Trump administration is in court right now trying to correct, especially the pre-existing conditions. And most black folks have some kind of pre-existing condition. Think about it. What does that mean? If you know somebody who has asthma, think about it. All the folks you know who have brain headaches. If you know of people who are, you know, suffering because they got injured on their job, all of those, because insurance companies will discriminate against them and deny them coverage or, you know, make them pay so much. If you know people with sugar, as people say, with diabetes, if you know people with other diseases, let's be very clear, high blood pressure, all of these problems, they are trying to take away coverage, make it hard for these people to be covered. So if you care about that, you better vote. I'm telling you right now, if you're thinking about how folks can't afford to go to college, can't afford to pay for college, can't afford to get higher education, should be voting, because it's under the Trump administration again that they've been cutting Pell Grants, where they've been cutting loan forgiveness, where they've been making it harder for people to go to college. And you want to be voting for your governor and voting for your state legislatures, because state legislatures can make it go to college, especially for community college. So there's a lot. Right. There's so much. I could go on. I could go on and on and talk about just trash pickup.
We're out of time. So what I need to have you do, though, is speak quickly about, and my apologies that we lost about 15 minutes of our time.
Oh, it's okay.
But speak to the coalition in order to deal with voter protection, voter mobilization, all a broad range of issues that are important moving into the 20. Know that there are people, broad spectrum of organizations who are on the case, who are trying to protect the vote, but also to ensure that people can get educated in election and beyond. So would you speak to the formation of this broad-based coalition?
Yes, we had a call last week, and we are organizing all over the country to make sure that we have a good ground game. That means that we are able to make sure that people are registered to vote, that voter education happens, that people are contacted and encouraged to vote, that GOTV happens, get out the vote happens, and that voter protection happens, so that people are, you know, from soup to nuts covered. and to fight against any form of voter suppression. So we are actively organizing. If you want more information, coalition.org, TJ Coalition. That's T as in transformative, J as in justice, coalition, C-O-A-L-I-R-G. You can find us at tjcoalition.org. Also, we have a website for Voting Rights Alliance. You can sign up to get information. You can sign up to be part of our coalition. We are organizing on the ground. We're serious about turning it around. 2012 and 2016, that the biggest difference in the elections was that 2 million less black votes were counted.
2 million.
I said
2 million.
2
wow.
million less black votes were counted because of, you know, all of this, you know, this encouragement, all of these things that happened. And we can turn that around. Imagine if we restore those 2 million votes. If we grow the additional 4 to 5% between 2016 and now, think about what that will mean to the elections. It will have all the impact several states. Just think about North Carolina, Florida, Ohio, Georgia. Just think about it. The same for
all those battleground states. Right. Well, Attorney Barbara Arnwine, the Executive Director of the Transformative Justice Coalition and also the host of Igniting Change, thank you for being with you occasionally to get the information out, because this is one of the most critical elections in the history of these United States. And I am, on behalf of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and many of your allies and partners, that this coalition is in place and that the Transformative Justice Coalition is on the case, making sure that we'll be able to mobilize and organize like never before. So thank you so much for spending time with us this afternoon on Vantage Point.
Thank you. Thank you, because you're the one who taught me about that.
Well, thank you so much. All right. All right. Okay. Well, again, you're listening to Vantage Point here on WBAI 99.5 FM. And I didn't get a chance to articulate them at the beginning. The first segment was on an assessment of the Supreme Court. Not the Supreme Court, the impeachment trial, getting over this trial. And we had an update coming from Askew Muhammad, who is a dear friend, around about another 30 minutes. An interview, I'll be interviewed. I've been recorded an interview for his show that will be playing you. And then, of course, we asked Attorney Barbara Arnwine to make the connection, which she did. She made the connection. Yeah, that boring, it don't matter, that impeachment trial, and what is happening vis-a-vis Russian interference into the black community, but other communities as well, but really heavily targeting the black community to suppress it. And then she talked about all the other schemes that are out there, too, and at the end talked about 2 million came off the rolls because of various shenanigans that take place. And we'll talk about this more at the end of the program, because I'm going to open up the lines for you to have your say. But when people are stopping you from doing something, you better take notice and say, well, if they're trying to stop me, why are they trying to stop me? And maybe that means you ought to be doing that which they're trying to stop you from doing. That doesn't mean you have to be blind about it, or it doesn't mean you have to be, without some sense of strategy and whatnot. But this issue is incredibly important moving forward into the 2020 election. We now want to turn our attention to a lot of debate is going on about strategy for the 2020 election. And of course, the Iowa caucuses are coming up, and there's a lot of pontificating and analysis and assessment. But within the progressive community, there's really a debate what should happen. And I'm delighted to have joining us now the editor and producer of Z Magazine, Michael Albert, who, myself included, are a part of an open letter to the Green Party to discuss presidential election strategy, or elections that we're now delighted to have joining us again. No stranger. I haven't had him on for quite a while, but he's been on frequently on Vantage Point. So we welcome now Michael.
Hi, Ron. Thanks a lot for having me.
Quickly, tell people... Yeah, tell people, again, just refresh people's memory about the magazine. There's some other Z Media-related products. Just sort of share that with the audience and how people can plug in.
Well, Z Magazine is a website. There is also now a podcast titled Revolution Z. And all these things are basically vehicles to try and communicate and how we might get it, vision and strategy. And they're easily found. I think that's probably enough.
In the past, and, you know, I often called on you as a strategist and political analyst and bunches of other things, because I really have a great deal of respect for how you have unpacked ideas as a progressive over these many years. And so, before we get to the Green Party, what, in your assessment, what is at stake in this particular election? Because it seems that, you know, people say every election and we need to vote. I mean, it's the worst thing. I mean, but there does seem to be some really, really, really critical reason why the history of this country. I'm saying that maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but the question is, what is at stake in this election?
You're not putting words in my mouth. I'm 72. I'll be 73 in my lifetime. Even comes close to what we're about to experience in the campaign period up until the election, and I've never seen an election that even comes close to being as important as this one. It's a mandate to do not what he's done, but much more. I think the results of that will be catastrophic unless somehow there is gigantic opposition that's organized, and even then it will be persist in trying to undo moderate progressive gains that have occurred in recent past, some bigger than others, all important. He will act in ways that risk the planet to global warming and to pollution and ecological backsliding on trying to do something ecological, to create a climate of hate and fear and doubt and hopelessness, which then in turn contributes to his ability audiences and introduce something that I'm not going to call fascism now, but is certainly akin in many ways kind of outcome. So I think this election is just, it's unprecedented in its importance and also in the dynamics that will be involved.
And I guess, and you touched on it to some degree, talking about hopelessness and the manipulation of information. But it is, to me, startling, and this was in the last election, clearly Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. I guess somewhere close to 3 million votes. So
yeah, that
was the majority. Though I must also say, and I mentioned this time and time again, there are vast numbers of people in this country who absolutely do not vote, who are on the sideline, who have been permanently alienated. We should unpack what the reasons are and for that and whatever. And there's a way in which somehow, particularly in these battleground states, the orange man, as I call him, was able to galvanize, and he has a bearings in the Republican Party. And I think it's important to say that Republican Party has changed to some degree because some new people have come into it. But 90% approval rating. How do you account for that? What are the? I mean, that's a significant. It's not the majority,
right,
but it's certainly a stubborn, intransient minority that's a sizable one
that stays with him. Yeah, I think it's. It is. It's obviously troubling. Incredibly, corporate elites, people, not only owning property but having vast incomes. Imagine them perhaps not liking some of his misogyny, perhaps not liking some of his racism, but hanging on anyway because, well, hell, he's delivering to my bank account. So that's one dynamic. But when you get beyond that, I don't know, but I think a considerable amount of it is just complete alienation from, and justified alienation from, both from the direction of the country, and some kind of peculiar wishful thinking that the orange man, as you say, is different. At least he, you know, says his mind, even if his mind is full of trash. But you know, they feel like he's. It's impossible to put your finger on, because on the other hand, he lies all the time, And it's demonstrated.
Right, absolutely.
And yet it doesn't turn people off to the idea that he's telling the truth. I think he comes across as plain-spoken and gutsy and above the fray and things like that. And it's a complete charade. It's a complete sham. And I don't blame the voter so much. I mean, if you live in a rural area of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, or Michigan, to take three contested states, and you look around and you see your town is falling apart, and a number of your friends are on opioids or dead, and the next generation is desperate for work that pays anything and that has any dignity, you just don't feel inclined to turn to anything familiar. And so this guy gets support. And then he does use racism and misogyny. He does rile people up against immigrants and so on. And that has historically had, you know, some resonance. I don't think that's the heart of it. I pray it's not the heart of it. I think the heart of it is a kind of real class consciousness about how bad the country is toward these white constituencies that are voting for him, and it is men and women. And we'll see. I happen to believe that Sanders could turn that around. But Sanders, of course, has to get past the gatekeepers of the Democratic Party. And he's doing an incredible job of trying to do that. It's going to get extreme. But there's a tendency in which those attacks on him, and this is something to hope for, say to some of the public, and maybe to some of Trump's, this guy's for real. This guy is hated by the elite. This guy, they see him as the enemy. Maybe there's something there for us to support. I actually think that might happen.
Particularly among working class people, particularly on issues of trade and NAFTA and some of these, question becomes, why then an open letter to the Green Party about 2020 election strategy? What are the sort of the key or the most salient points in this open letter to the Green Party?
I think that the issues are really very simple, but they're made complicated often. I worry about one green policy. It's not the green platform that bothers me. I like it. It's not the things Greens get. The Green Party is a really good progressive organization on the right side or the left side of almost every issue. It's one policy choice. They run. I don't mind that at all. But they not only run in California and New York, or for that matter, Texas, and that are not contested, states in which one side or the other is clearly going to win. They also run in very close contested states. So in the last election, for example, and, you know, others, there are about 10, I think. And in those states, when they run, there's a problem. And the problem is that they can shift votes from voting or to voting for the Green candidate, last time around Stein. We don't know who it'll be this time. Instead, or the Democrat, not just if it's Sanders or Warren, but even if it's Biden. Why? Because so much is at stake. And so the debate becomes, Green Party, of not running a candidate, but instead running its platform in the contested states and running to create an opposition that will continue on after the election, running a candidate who is certainly not going to win, but is just going to get a certain number of votes, more than the cost of the possibility of Trump winning. The reality of four contested states last time would have swung the Electoral College. As insane as the Electoral College is, as much as it should be turned and you know, eliminated, it's there this time. And so those votes can matter. And also how people organize and campaign can matter. And so trying to get a calm, reasoned, mutually respectful debate of not whether the Greens are good or not, the letter signers agree. Bad or not, the letter signers agree. It is. but just of this particular choice to risk contributing to a Trump reelection, but this can be won, and it can even be a pivotal one. So to risk that, or to instead choose a different course which doesn't risk that. That's what the letter was about, and some good discussion that, you know, might even yield a change in views.
And so, in essence, the letter calls really for what's called like a safe ballot strategy. Is that fair to say that,
yeah,
that the Greens would put forth presidential candidates in full slates in those states? You know, the New York is going to be a blue state, and you know the Greens can, yeah, you know, this won't matter, and there are other states that, in fact, I mean, you look. It really comes down to only a few states that are contested, because most states are either red or battleground states. They are the Michigans, the Ohio, the Pennsylvania. You know, there are a number of the years, and maybe nine or so really determine the outcome, given this antiquated thing called the Electoral College, but is a fact of life. So I just wonder what is being
that's exactly right.
You know, is being talked about.
Exactly,
and
right.
And I guess the other point I would want to raise, because, you know, there is, and, you know, in the past, maybe I've been guilty of it too, way back a while, and this, you know, it's Tweedledee, it's Tweedledum, it's lesser evil, and there may have been times when, but I think we have an obligation to analyze for its own, dare I say, contraries and contradictions, and they're not all the same, so you just can't sort of differences in different periods.
Yeah.
So the question becomes, because you mentioned Biden. Well, some people said, oh, God, it's okay. You mentioned Warren and Bernie Sanders, but now you're mentioning Biden. My God, this is horrible. But, I mean, I think people have to also ask themselves, and again, we on WBII do not talk about preferences and so forth, so this is my own opinion. I mean, I would not be favoring Biden. But the difference between Biden and Trump is not, like, even close. The difference between Biden and Warren and Sanders is a gap, but the gap between Biden, being added policy by policy, moral and ethical behavior by moral and ethical behavior, which also should count, is not. And so that's the other thing, that sometimes we get caught in the rhetorical repetition of political line and political ideas that sort of are designed to resonate and be popular and capture. But there are moments in history when we do have to step back and take a sober look at things and say, this Tweedledee, Tweedledum, lesser evil thing is not applicable at this point because there's something bigger and more dangerous taking place. So, I mean, I'm just throwing that in as a part of the commentary.
I agree with you, and I have no problem saying we have one political party with two wings of one political party, and that one political party is about reproducing and maintaining, you know, the hierarchies of wealth and power. I say that. I believe that. However, we also have a situation in which every now and then the gap between, because these parties, these two wings of one party, contest. And they contest.
That's right.
With different positions, oftentimes representing different constituencies. And the constituency that Trump represents is not only, you know, the 0.1% rich, empowered, property-owning group, which is typical of the Republican Party. The Democrats tend to represent a larger sector of the elite. But the Republicans now are also the party of the most racist, anti-science, anti-reason, lying constituencies in the country. That's a factor. The Democrats, this is not something I like, but as a party, they are largely supporting the same property elites, but also largely beholden to the what I call the coordinator class, the professionals, the managers, high-income employees, and so on. Now, I have no love lost with this group, but it does have different priorities. But now, incredibly, there's also another element in the Democratic Party. There's Sanders, and even to an extent, Warren. And there's various younger elected officials in more local offices, and these people are actually far more progressive than anything, again, I've seen in a long, long time. It isn't just, I wouldn't just celebrate a Sanders victory because Trump lost. I would celebrate a Sanders victory because Sanders is really good. And I would celebrate a Warren victory because she's good, pretty good, right? Ordinarily, my reaction to Democratic Party candidates is they're repulsive. I think Clinton was horrible, but I think that it was important for Clinton to beat Trump, and she didn't. And one of the reasons she didn't was votes in contested states, which that is where she lost. All right, so life is a little more complex than having one Democratic Party has been vile. There's two wings of one party. Sometimes you have to have a second correct observation. Good Lord is not even a nightmare. It is way beyond a nightmare. And so at certain points in history, likely to take a more subtle approach, which goes further. I'll tell you the truth. I live in Massachusetts. I haven't voted for my life except in the mayoral election in Boston when a guy named Mel King was running, who I thought was really, really good. George McGovern didn't induce me to vote. But this time around, if I was in a contested state and perhaps a little younger, and I'd maybe even try it at my age, I'd be killing myself to support beating Trump. And that's gap.
Right.
And I guess one last thing about the letter. The letter that we wrote, the idea was to try a discussion of the policy, whether to run a campaign like last time, the Greens, or whether to change up a bit. We wanted to try without it devolving into things that really have nothing to do with it and that are interpretations or mishearings. And that's partly why the letter was done. The people who signed the letter, I can't be accused of being agents of the Democratic Party or shills for the Democrats, or people who, you know, really don't oppose injustice. I mean, it's just, you can't say that about Chomsky.
Yeah, well, and I think it's important, I think it would be important to just sort of talk about the signatories, too. That was going to be my
next
question.
Let me see if I can, it was you and I, Chomsky, Barbara Ehrenreich, Norman Solomon, Bill Fletcher, Cynthia Peters, and Leslie Kagan. I think that's all of them.
Right.
Now, that's it's not a question of believing these folks because times. No. And it's not a case of accepting what they have to say, just because they're saying it. Of course not. But I do think that, plus the fact that the letter says it agrees with the Greens about all sorts of issues, hopefully would force sort of dismissing the issue of this tactic, this issue of how to campaign on grounds that it's being proposed or to want to, advance the Democratic Party or whatever else.
Right.
And would in fact take place on the grounds of, okay, how much worse is a Trump reelection? How much then harm is it to Greens to avoid the possibility of contributing to a catastrophe? How do we weigh those off, and therefore what kind of strategic choice do we make?
Right.
Well, a number of places have run the letter. I don't even know all of them. I wish there were more. I honestly think that some people, don't want to get caught up in a fight, in a dispute, in ad hominem attacks. And I'm hoping that the letter can forestall that. But I understand wanting to not be involved in that. I don't want to be involved in that either. I'm sure you don't either. Not address. There has been some reactions. I don't know what everybody has seen. I've gotten some email. Some email have, you know, been supportive and thankful for the letter having been run and hopes that there'll be the discussion. And some has been not supportive, have disagreed with the letter. Regrettably, some has been, I don't know what word to use, ad hominem, just dismissive without addressing it. We'll see.
Well, let me just say that
the truth is, actually, the up-to-the-minute truth is, I just got a email that I haven't even read yet, which includes an article by Howie Hawkins, who may well be the presidential candidate of the Greens, responding to the letter. And, you know, we'll put that on ZNet, of course. And I don't know. I hope there will be an open, thoughtful discussion of these issues.
Well, let me just say you're listening to Point 5 here in New York on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with YCRadio.org. Bert, he is the editor and producer of Z Magazine and ZNet and a number of other media, progressive media outlets, if you will. And we're discussing an open letter to the Green. That letter can also be found if you go to the IBW website right now, IBW21.org. You can see it. And I hope people will, because I'm going to be opening that we're going to ask the audience to respond to is, should the Green Party adopt a safe, I forgot what the term is now.
Policy.
A state-to-state strategy in the 2020 election. If so, why? If not, why not? And maybe there's some alternative views at all. That's 21.org. You'll see it prominently featured on the IBW website. It's in green, so you'll see it. and the Howie Hawkins letter, I have great regard for, I think many people do, for Howie Hawkins. He's been on, haven't had as close to Howie as I once was when I ran for president in 1992. I had a lot of interaction with the Green Party, his courage, his vision, his strength, his determination. I did get a chance to sort of peruse his position. We will post that. I just want people to hear the different perspectives. And, you know, essentially, you know, Howie is not being dismissive in a negative way, but he is taking this is no different. Essentially, this is like it's always, they're all battleground states. The Greens have to be in battle everywhere. This election is, you know, the Democrats are the Democrats. And, you know, it almost essentially says this moment is no different. And if Trump is elected, it's going to be bad. But even if Democrats are elected, it'll be bad also. So it's a pretty routine line, is what I would say, in terms of what I saw in the to also engage with the audience as well, because I think this is about really having mature debate and discussion and doing it in a way that does respect the different positions. And I would say that I have certainly said over the years, and I would think many people agree, there's a basic flaw, so-called democracy, but one of the major flaws in the electoral system per se is the lack of rank voting or instant runoff voting. I mean, and that's a rebound and be fighting for like hell in all of these states, because then that would take away this whole notion, because it is highly likely that in these, even in the contested states, that if a candidate of the Green Party or any other party for that matter that's progressive that may be running, if they had a Sanders or a Warren, and, you know, given the stakes, and maybe even a Biden, we're now deprived of that opportunity, except in a state like New York, where I guess there is the opportunity because of fusion. But anyway, that's something we all need to push for. So I've always sort of tried to say that, you know, I'm native one. I want to make that clear. And, you know, if people choose to do that, then I don't, you know, I'm not trying to berate them for doing that. But there does need to be, and I think we all should be pushing for the kind of reforms in the system that would provide rank voting or instant runoff voting, because that would be a qualitative incremental step that would allow us to vote for who we want and vote for who we believe in, and build substantial support for that, because historic ideas have been amassed around certain ideas. And this is the other thing that the Greens are doing. They're looking state by state to put forth policies that they want to aggregate votes around, so there can be leverage within the system. That's admirable, but we need to find ways to amplify that, and doing that process would be very helpful. Well, Michael Albert, any final words before I have to cut you loose in terms of the way forward?
Of course, you know, I agree about ranked voting. I just want to be clear that it isn't a question of let's say Howie was the Green presidential candidate. Nobody's saying he shouldn't run. I'm certainly not. There are 40 states that he can run in with no issue. There's 10 states where it's a real decision. Does he want to run in those states in a way that might aid Trump, or does he want to run in those states in a way that won't matter? Well, he could. He could go in those states, and he could tell the constituency that the Green Party can speak to that it's crucial to vote for whoever the Democrat is to stop Trump, but it's also crucial to sign up and join with the Greens in fighting for the program after the election. Allow whoever that candidate is to speak out and to fight for change, but without risking the possibility of Trump re-election is bad for the world, it's bad for the U.S., it's bad for the Greens, it's bad for anybody. And the gap in badness between Trump getting elected and any Democrat is huge, albeit electing Sanders would be really very, very, very positive.
All right, Michael Albert, thank you for spending time with us today, and we hope that we've contributed to the discussion. I certainly believe that's important, and one of the reasons why WBAI and the Pacifica Network is important. It is one of the outlets in which we can have these discussions and have these debates in a way that provides more time other than 2 or 3 minutes. You know, we can really, really dig more deeply into them. So we appreciate it. And we'll, again, the letter can be found on the IBW website at ibw21.org. We're also going to post Howie Hawkins' response and Mike, give again the website and whatnot.
Yeah, all this material is there also, of course. The easiest thing for your listeners to do, because people don't remember URLs in their head, is just look up ZNET on Google, and you'll see on Google, and you'll find it. It's the simplest thing to remember. It's what I remember. So I hope that will help.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate you spending time.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a break here. We're going to eventually get the audience in. I have to take a break. We've had no break. We're going to take a five-minute break for station announcements and upcoming events and all kinds of things that are important in terms of our beloved WBAI. This is the Professor, Dr. Ron Daniels. The show is Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM. In collaboration with ycradio.org. We're going to come right back after this break, and I have a few announcements, and then we're going to open up the phones to you, our listening audience. We'll be right back in 5 minutes. and we appreciate Taft taking that break, and we are now ready to resume. The phone number to call, given the conversation we had, and of course we had an analysis of the impeachment trial, and drew a direct commitment and Russian interference in the 2016 election, and prospect of redoing so, and the black vote, and all of that with Barbara Arnwine, who is the executive director of the Transformative Justice Coalition that's being put together to both mobilize, educate, and protect the black vote. And then an open letter to the Green Party on 2020 election strategy with Michael Albert. And we hope people had a chance to hear that and digest it. Go to the web. It's very long, but you get the drift of it pretty quickly. But the issue is, should the Green Party adopt a safe state strategy in 2020? What that would mean is not in running a presidential candidate in 40 states, but not running a presidential candidate in 10 states, which are the so-called battleground states, runs the risk potentially of contributing to the reelection of the orange man. So that's the discussion. That's the debate. We want people to call in and share their perspective on that at 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. While you're doing that, let me catch up on some things I wanted to do at the beginning. I mean, obviously, I wanted to start the show by sending condolences to the family of Kobe Bean Bryant, a.k.a. because of this tragic accident. He was, of course, Kobe Bryant, a legendary basketball player, but also a global icon in the whole world. I mean, across the world, people are mourning more tragic because on the plane of nine people was his 13-year-old daughter, who was an aspiring basketball player herself, and her friends, some of her friends, as they were going to a basketball game, the pilot, because all life is precious, his daughter, Gigi Gianna. And so we just simply want to salute, of course, Kobe Bryant, but also to pass on to the family our condolences, if you will, because you know, we've had this great tragedy occur. Again, just be patient for this. Those of you who are lining up, 212-20. I want to announce that beginning next week, and every first Monday of every first Monday of every month, we're introducing a segment called on Vantage Point called the State of Newark Report. The State of Newark Report, which will feature the Honorable Roz J. Baraka, the mayor of Newark, New Jersey. And that'll be our, which we're introducing beginning next week. We hope the mayor will be available next Monday, because that's the first Monday in February. I think it's February 4th. If not, his senior policy advisor and communications strategist will be on to talk about the segment and what we intend to do with it, which is very clear. We believe that Newark, New Jersey, the policies that are being advocated are progressive policies, that there's an effort to beat back gentrification, to talk about creating forms of democratic economy. And, of course, the Institute of the Black World 21st Century has been focused on helping to advance that cause. We think that's consistent with what many of our viewers on WBAI believe in. And so we want to have this segment available to Mayor Baraka the first Monday of every month to give a State of Newark report. And there's some beautiful, I mean, some amazing things that are happening in Newark, and we want that to be shared. Secondly, First Century is declaring 2020 the year of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. This is the 100th anniversary of his convening of the International Convening of the Negro Peoples of the World in 2020, in which he turned out Square Garden. And so we're going to be beginning next week, actually, a 10-month campaign, a 10-month mass education campaign of Garvey. And that will be leading into State of the Black World Conference 5, State of the Black World Conference 5, tentatively scheduled for Newark, New Jersey, December. After the election, and Dr. Julius Garvey, the son of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, has agreed to be the honorary chairperson. We hope to have him on next Monday to kick it off, but if not, he will recommend someone else. Likely, it may well be Dr. Leonard Jeffries to begin this series of discussions, because I will begin incorporating sections on Marcus Garvey throughout the year as we launch this major project. And I think our pledge drive starts next week, so it'll be all things Garvey in terms of the premiums that I will be selecting as educational vehicle for our listening audience. And finally, WBAI buddies. Even before we get to next week, WBAI buddies are always needed. WBAI buddies are those persons who step forward, understanding that the listener, as we've been looking for, within the context of a community listener-sponsored radio station, which is what WBAI, a fortress of resistance and transformation, all $10 a month, $120 a year, to be sustaining contributors to WBAI, including starting today, are welcome to do so and encouraged to do so by going to ibgoingtowbai.org. That's give to WBAI.org. You can do it through your credit card, your savings account, and debit cards and whatnot to make this happen. There's a ton of benefits that also come with it. Okay, let's begin to have the conversation with our listening audience. 212-209-2877. The question is, should the Green Party adopt a safe state strategy for the 2020 strategy? Means, again, they would not run a presidential candidate in 10 battleground states, but would run candidates in the other 40 states. Let's go to our listening audience. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm waiting for you. Yeah, you're on air.
Okay. Well, you know, I heard the question that you asked, but I have a question, too. Do you think the Democratic Party has tried to make inroads into the African-American community at all? I mean, I don't see it. I don't see it. I mean, I don't know anybody that's went on Facebook or Twitter to find out who they're going to vote for. I don't know anybody. I know lots of people, you know. There was nobody on the ground saying that, hey, you know, you should vote for the Democratic Party, and if you vote for the Democratic, I mean, I saw like...
Well, I don't know where... Well, I mean, the answer to your question is, if you're talking about the 2016 election, certainly, and that was a major election. There was a lot of voter suppression, Attorney Armwine pointed out, but the airways were literally, and certainly there were, I don't know about Facebook, because I'm not frankly one who spends a lot of time or almost any time on social media. I just don't. But on radio, television, mailers, flyers, there was tremendous push in the 2016 election to mobilize and organize the black vote. The problem was that, and this is a spiel, and I think correctly so, that the Democratic Party never rewards black voters for their loyalty to the degree of their support for the party, nor in terms of the needs that black constituencies have. This was even true, in my opinion, under President Barack Obama, because there was a reluctance to do race-specific policies based on the need for jobs, economic development, though I'm a criminal justice policy sort of move things forward in that regard. But there's always, and there's always efforts to organize the black vote. So, you know, I don't know how to answer that question other than I did in that manner. So thanks much. Appreciate your call. Others can call it 212-209-2877. We have lines that are wide open for you to get into this conversation. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Good afternoon. My name is Frank. I'm from Harlem. And you learn there about the Electoral College. It's 550 people, 270 people determine who the president is. So the popular election, the presidency, it's the Electoral College. So we, at an election day at midnight when the Democrats have won by 5 million, but the Electoral College turns it over to the Republicans, what are you going
to do? You have to win in the contested states. You have to win.
I'm not talking about contested states. I'm talking about the Electoral College.
I understand
they
the
meet
Electoral
in
College.
December, one month after
me,
the election.
Excuse me. I understand the Electoral College. If the Electoral College is a fact, that is the reality, whether I like it or not. The Electoral College is not the popular vote, which is what you're saying, that determines who wins. It is the Electoral College vote. So what it means is, in reality, that is, it is the popular vote in the key within those key battleground states that make the difference. That's what made the difference in the last election. It was Pennsylvania. It was Wisconsin. It was Ohio. It was several battleground states. That's what they're defined as. And in those states, Trump won over Hillary Clinton by about 80,000 to 100,000 votes total. So if, in fact, there had been a heavier voter turnout, including black voters, who for many, many reasons, the votes were taken away, long lines, all kind of things to suppress that vote. But the black people had broken through anyway. And indeed, if others had decided it was worthwhile in those states, then the orange man would have been denied being president of the United States. So that's the battleground. That is the nature of the terrain that this battle is being fought on in terms of whether or not Trump will be, or the orange man will be, reelected in 2020. His people are going to turn out. They're loyal. As he said, if he shot somebody on Fifth Avenue or whatever, they would still be in his camp. The question, and that means intensity. The question is, how intense do people feel about getting rid of the orange man, and if they feel intense about it? It's not going to be waged in New York. It's not going to be waged in California. It's not going to be waged in New Jersey and some of these states where, it's going to be in those states where it's going to be tight, like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, again. So that's the issue. That's the question. And that's why the notion of whether a state strategy becomes an important question, no matter how you feel one way or another, because people might still say they think it's important because of the goals and objectives of the Green Party. That is a valid position. We just do 209-287-7212. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Mr. Daniels.
Yeah, speak up.
Can you hear me?
We're not hearing you. Speak up a little louder, or maybe we're having trouble with our audio, but speak up a little louder.
Can you hear me? I wanted to ask you, because you had said that there was a large gap between the orange guy and Biden, and I wanted to, and do you believe that before he became the vice president, do you believe that he had racist tendencies, racist views, and before he became president?
Who, Biden?
Joe Biden.
No, I don't believe that. I think Joe Biden has been a moderate liberal for most of his life. I think there were some instances in which he made some decisions to try to maybe accommodate, to build some consensus and whatever. And Kamala Harris raised some of those points. Some other points have been raised. But by and large, he's been a pretty reliable liberal, a moderate liberal for most of his political career. Let me just say this. Even if he were a blue dog Democrat, or if he were a Democrat, there is still a huge gap between that. If you go policy by policy by policy, between that and which is being articulated if I look at the Democratic field, there are some people who, I'm not too impressed with. But all of them, I don't see who is not vastly superior to any to the orange man, without question. It's not even close.
Okay, thank you for your opinion.
All right, appreciate it. 212-209-2877. And the way to do this, by the way, is to check it off. You check off policies. Where do they stand on the living wage? Where do you stand on health care? Where stand on the right of labor to organize and maintain unions? Where does the orange man stand on climate change? Where does the orange man stand on immigration? I mean, you go point by point by point. The environmental regulations. women's rights, you go LGBTQ rights, just go down the line, point by point by point, and Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, go down the line. And you see vast differences between his retrograde, pro-elite, pro-1% positions, and you Buttigieg's, Klobuchar. I mean, their positions are different than the orange man. But there are some candidates who have a more progressive view. Bernie Sanders would be that. And Elizabeth Warren, in my opinion, have the most progressive views. They're the most out front. They're willing to stretch the system much more so to really, really build a stronger democratic economy and so forth. But others are more cautious. And so if you take health care, Bernie Sanders is Medicare for All. That is a single payer system that revolutionizes or transforms the American health system. The other candidates say, let's improve on Obamacare. Well, hey, Obamacare ain't bad to the extent that you once had millions of people who had no health insurance at all, that you now have millions who do have health insurance. Then you have the Republicans saying get rid of it, period, which means you're back to millions and millions who don't. That's how you have to kind of look at it. So I don't want a public option by itself. I don't want to just improve on Obamacare. That's my view. But when you look at what the orange man is talking about, he's talking about getting rid of health care as a human right, period. I mean, that's kind of how you have to calibrate it, in my humble opinion. 212-209-2877. Let's go back to our listening audience. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Hi, this is Lynn.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Mitch, I'm on the air. I'll speak real quick because I have a few concerns. One thing people should check out for themselves, there's a lawyer named Jonathan Simon, and I heard him being interviewed 6 months before the election, whoever the candidate was, although he said it looks like it's going to be Trump. But he said not because he's going to win, but because the Republicans would steal the election, which is exactly what they did. You probably know people off the voter rolls 2 weeks before the election. In Wisconsin alone, they were waiting. It was at 12 midnight. I was watching NBC. They were waiting for the count to come in. This was Madison. But he was like the voter historian. He said, Madison is a Democratic place, voted for in the primary in 2015. He said, so Trump is only up by 22,000 votes. He said, when the votes came in, this man looked whiter than he already was. He could not believe it. His anchor host, a woman, she said, what's wrong? This is impossible. He said, are you telling me that out of 134,000 Democrats that voted in Madison, Wisconsin, 18,000 voted? They completely stole that 18,000, and the Democrats didn't even fight. Hillary did not fight. She knew that that was 123,000 Democrats that had just voted in the primary.
Much was stolen, how much was suppressed, and so forth. We had a guest on at the beginning who is an expert at this, who's been doing it, and in total, you're right. There were, through various means, including purging people who should not have been purged, for example, in Florida, who had the right to vote. They had people who had done their time, and they shouldn't have had the right to vote. Who were knocked off. There were various schemes. There is no question that there were various schemes employed, and those schemes will be employed again. So what does that mean? That means that you have to take that into account, and you have to overwhelm the system. You have to overwhelm the system in terms of moving on the ballot box in such a way that it becomes far more difficult for the theft to take place. And putting in place various protections. That's what Barbara Arnwine, Attorney Arnwine, is talking about. making sure that we have people deployed in the field. We have making sure that we're our eyes are wide open in various states in terms of what the strategies and tactics are going to be, anticipating those in order to fight back, because it is going to be down and dirty, no question about it. But because it's down and dirty, we should not be discouraged from pushing forward to march on those battle box in numbers that are unprecedented, because even with all of the things that happened in the 2016 election, there were literally not only black and white, millions. In any one given election in this country, only about 52 to 55% of the total eligible electorate turns out to vote. People jump up and down as if this is some great, phenomenal victory. That means millions. That means 45% of the people did not even register or did not vote. If you go to Canada, if you go to Germany, if you go to France, you go any other place, it's 80%. It's 85%. The biggest, one of the biggest jokes about America is that elections, really, people are alienated. They don't get out. That means, really, if you're the, if you organize, people who organize, I've said it over and over again, in a low participation environment, those who organize will win, and they'll have power disproportionate to that number. So that's what's happening, you know, right now. So look, thanks so much. Appreciate your call. You're on point that they're against the theft, and we have to hit them so hard with our numbers that they'll be overwhelmed. Let's go back to our next caller, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. Good afternoon,
Dr. Daniel. Thank you for your show.
Good afternoon.
I wasn't listening from the beginning, but I want you to know, have you decided who you're going to
vote? Well, if I did, I'm not allowed to say so on the air.
All right. But in terms of the persons who are the Democratic up for nomination, no. I think the most electable person is Bernie. Read the article that Zephyr Teachout wrote in The Guardian about Joe Biden's record and why he would not be the best candidate. I'll listen all fair, thanks.
Yeah, well, I will say this, that my belief is that there is no question that the strategic priority at this moment is to defeat the orange man, period. And I believe that any of the Democratic candidates that I see in the field right now, I don't see any Democrat in the field today that I would not, I mean, I would vote for any of the Democrats in the field right now, any of them, across the board. There's seven or eight left, whether it's the Yang guy and it's the Bennett from who's not on the ballot, or Klobuchar, Buttigieg, Biden, Warren, Sanders, are the two most progressive candidates. But I would vote for any of them over Trump, any of them. And there may be people who have some flaws. There may be in their closets. But nobody has as much baggage as the orange man. It's not even close. It's like, in fact, I wrote and go through the website and look through Vantage Point. I wrote an article that said that if Trump were elected, Trump would be like Reagan on steroids. We're talking about baggage on Harrison. Between the orange man and any of these Democratic candidates, that people would really, really soberly look at it. So this one said this and that. Yeah, all of them. I may be able to pick and choose. Even with Bernie Sanders, I may have some issues. I don't like focuses on class more than he does race. He does not, to me, stress race issues sufficiently, in my opinion. And yet, I still see him as the most progressive candidate. So I'm not going to say because Bernie Sanders is not dealing with race as much as I would like for him to do, that somehow that becomes a disqualifier. That's not, to me, you have to look at the totality of the picture. There's no question that he has, not only has Bernie Sanders the most progressive candidate, he has moved the spectrum. Medicare for All was an extreme issue 4 years ago. It is now. There's so many different things that education, the possibility of having education paid for by all these issues predicted that. If you have a strong progressive movement, it will move the content of public policy pronouncements and decisions to the left. And that's why you run strong progressive candidates. Elizabeth Warren, similarly, but not quite as much as Bernie Sanders. And the other phenomenal reality is that Bernie Sanders has run his campaign without corporate money. Both he and Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, more than Warren, have demonstrated you don't have to take money from the corporate elite If you have a strong message and you have small donors, you can have an army. And that's what we should be looking for. We should be looking to defeat the orange man, but goes for a big change that really moves the progressive agenda forward. But failing that, let's say that, then any Democrat who's in the field today is preferable to the orange man. He is the existential, and what he represents is the existential danger of the hour. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello? Hi.
Hello. You're on the air.
Thank you, Dr. Daniels. I enjoy your program very much, and I understand you can't be committal. But one thing Bernie Sanders did do, is, which may not increase his votes, is that he has talked about people in prison after they come out, or even in prison being allowed to vote, which I support, but which has caused a lot of people to question me. And the other thing by Zephyr Teachout, I know you want to support anyone, preferably, but I think that that article talked a lot of truth.
Let me just stop you right there.
Uh-huh.
Let's say that the article, and I don't know that's all of the stuff in the article is true. Are you telling me that when this election comes out, it's a choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, you're gonna stay home or vote for Trump?
Is that we should know these differences and not believe that it's just fake news, that Biden and even Obama tried to put Social Security on the table a few times at least. Anyway, the other issue
I'm familiar with, there were some discussions. There were some there were some discussions about some of those areas. I think I recollect those discussions. I'm willing to bring some people on to talk about that. That has to deal with the question of, is Social Security and Medicare really in trouble or not, and what do you do about it, and what are the formulas? I happen to disagree with cutting Social Security. I happen to agree with Bernie Sanders' position. There's a series of other policies that can be taken that really make sure that makes, but it does not mean, even if Obama and Biden were trying to, because these debates have to happen about what do you do about social issues, and they may have taken a more conservative, more moderate position than I would like. That's one position out of many positions. Where does he stand on climate change?
The same thing. If you look at his positions, I'm not saying not to vote for him if it comes down to that, but the same thing, the same holistic. And in the past, he has said,
I have heard that we have to fight for a living wage. We have to fight for an increase in the minimum wage. So I don't know. Maybe my ears are hearing something different. Good afternoon. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking the call. And I just wanted to say you had focused mostly on race, on class, and didn't say enough about race. But I have some good news for you. And that is that I'm looking at an accordion printout that's the size, actually, of a personal business card, but a business card's attached, and it says, "What would it be like if our country was run for the benefit of regular, everyday people, Bernie?" And then there's a listing of 1, 2, 3, 4 different justice, racial justice, and environmental justice, and social justice. And under racial justice, there's a number of bullet points, all Americans. Criminal justice reform and community investments.
Yeah, let me just say that.
And racial.
Let me just say, I'm running out of time. I have similar bullet points. Almost all of them do. What I'm saying is, when I hear the debates and when I hear the stump speeches, I'm sure there's some bullet points. I mean, I think you could see almost any of the candidates have a racial justice component. But it's buried somewhere. It's not what you hear them talking about. I would expect, and have been pushing, and many people have been pushing you know, for Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren has actually been better than Bernie Sanders in terms of more publicly articulating from the stage. But that doesn't mean that's not a disqualifier for me, because I think that Bernie Sanders is the most progressive candidate. And that's what I'm trying to get other people to look at it as well, that you don't take one particularly really, really bad thing. But in this election, it really doesn't at one level matter. You know, I'm willing to examine all of them, all of the flaws of all of these candidates. But at the end of the day, there's not a Democratic candidate that I see who is not. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your call. Well, folks, we got to wrap it up. Oh, boy, it's been a, you know, we want to continue to have these conversations. We've got some issues we got to be doing because we lost time this show and last show because of that. But just want to reiterate that starting next Monday, we're going to have the State of Newark report. We do hope the Honorable Ross, one of his leading deputy mayors or strategists, to be on to talk about the progressive policies that are being enunciated in Newark. We begin next week dealing with the Garvey year, the year of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, and much more. So, appreciate you being on, listening in today. This is the Professor Dr. Ryan, 0.5 FM, in collaboration with YCRadio.org. We'll see you again here next week on Vantage Point. Thank you.